My name is Edward Champion, and I'm the producer of this podcast. Now, you might be wondering why this NPR opening is here, why the music hasn't started, and why Mr. Segundo has not yet shouted into the mic. Well, have no fear, we'll get to all that fun in just a minute. But I wanted to remind all our listeners here that if you haven't yet thrown in a few bucks with the American Red Cross National Disaster Fund, we here at the Bat Segundo Show highly encourage you to do so. Whether it's $2, $20, $200, or even $2,000 if you have it sitting around, the people who have lost their homes could really use your help. And if you happen to run into President Bush or FEMA Director Michael Brown in the not-too-distant future, well, we also encourage you to let off a few raspberries or perhaps moon them at your earliest convenience. Perhaps you might want to send them slices of cake, given that their collective response is clearly inspired by Marie Antoinette. Anyway, that is all. Hope you enjoy the show. Jorge, comience la musica.
De un apartamental polga infestado, vienen los livings de un hombre encantador. It's Bat Segundo!
Gracias, Jorge. Remind me to send you a Hallmark. Kids, this is Bat Segundo, and I've been holed up in a motel room watching CNN for the past 3 days. I was quite alone and quite afraid, and I wanted to do something bad to Wolf Blitzer. Something carnal, perhaps. But I had Johnny Walker for company. If there's one real-life lesson that I've learned as a functional alcoholic, it's this. Keep pressing on no matter how bad it gets. Well, with this in mind, our young roving correspondent talked with Periel Ashenbrand. She is the founder and president of Body As Billboard, which specializes in risque t-shirts, which I understand come quite in handy at a wet t-shirt contest. But no matter, Ashenbrand's t-shirts are political in nature. She also protested the 2004 Republican convention in her underwear, and she's written a new book called The Only Bush I Trust Is My Own. I can certainly relate to this title. I once woke up in a clinic waiting room. It seems that I had blacked out the night before, and as the receptionist and nurses informed me, I had specifically asked for a sex change operation. That was surprising, but just before the doctors were prepared to put me under the knife that morning, I managed to escape. Ever since then, I've been trying to get in touch with my feminine side. Unfortunately, both my left side and my right side are masculine in nature, and I've run out of sites to explore, even after serving as a trick for several transvestite hookers. Well, Miss Ashenbrand is more the woman than I'll ever be, and our young roving correspondent had quite the provocative conversation with her.
So I'm here with Periel Ashenbrand, who has a book called The Only Bush I Trust Is My Own, which is, as everyone I'm sure has remarked to you, a fantastic title.
Thank you.
I wanted to first of all talk about the tone of this memoir. I saw the cover, of course, and I read the back flap copy, and I was sort of expecting a political memoir, but what I got, interestingly enough, was a very personal memoir. So I was wondering, was there a balance between the personal and the political during the course of this, or how did you stumble upon this tone?
I don't know. I think it's the tone that's most natural for me. I mean, I don't think I set out to write a memoir, even.
Oh, really?
Per se, but I didn't have some clear idea that, oh, I want to write a personal book or a political book, but I think it's just more natural, I mean, authentic, actually, you know, sort of.
Gotcha.
Comedy. Well,
what was the real impetus for this book? What sort of spawned it?
Well, what spawned the title was the fact that I had been making these shirts that said The Only Bush I Trust Is My Own, and had been working on a nonfiction book, which was essentially about, you know, what was going on.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that more than a memoir, I think I would describe my work as sort of about what's going on. And since that is what was going on, that seemed to be what, in part at least, the book became about.
Gotcha. So did you find the political voice kind of being drowned out by the personal voice because of the success of Body as Billboard, or?
No, I mean, I think the book is sort of political because I am, you know, but certainly it's not Michael Moore or Al Franken book. I mean, the politics are there and they're important, and I am socially aware and conscious, and I think that those things are critical, but it's also a little bit of a comedy routine, I think, you know, between myself and my mother and myself and my friend Kat.
The sense I got was that Body as Billboard almost came about from accident. Do you think that you would have eventually sort of stumbled upon this business had you not sort of taken up silkscreen? Or?
No, I mean, no way. I can't imagine how I would have ever set out to start a t-shirt company.
Yeah.
I think I probably would have just kept writing and writing.
Now, your book spends a sizable portion, of course, talking, a lot of it is actually a conversation between you and your mother.
Yeah.
And did she get a chance to read the book before you went to press? Because there are some moments in the book where you know, she was kind of like, please don't write about this, Perry.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I read her large portions of it before it went to press. Oh my God, you're not going to write that. You can't write that. It's something that, you know, she says over and over again. But, I mean, well, anyway, obviously it's in the book nevertheless.
Gotcha. Well, did you clear all sort of things with friends, or did you just kind of just run like a loose cannon through this? Or?
No, I mean, I got a fair amount of clearance from most people.
No Augustine Burroughs kind of situation.
Well, we'll see. Yeah. The book hasn't been out
for...
Turned
into a movie yet.
Yeah. It's only been out for about a week, so I don't know. Maybe we'll stumble upon something like that. I changed many names, and the people whose names I didn't change signed various documents.
Oh, okay. The usual legal...
I would just get my friends drunk and be like, hey, you know, will you sign this for me, please?
Gotcha. Now, in this book, you actually came out adamantly against online dating. I was curious if you could expand upon that. You just sort of like said, there's the guy named Craig who has this sort of thing where you can get everything from a blowjob to whatever. But I'm wondering, you didn't really sort of go into detail, and I wanted to sort of touch upon this because...
Well, I don't know if I came out against online dating. I think that, I mean, I don't know that I was railing against it in general. I think I was, it's more that I would personally be much too paranoid to meet somebody that way, and some of the experiences that my friends have had have been quite frankly shocking.
Wow.
And you know, people not exactly as they said they were, as they described themselves to be, and sort of these really wild and hilarious tales of that.
So is it sort of more of a, I was just curious if it was like a false impression or a first impression thing?
A false impression that one would get from meeting someone online?
Like someone might give you a false impression from who they really are, or whether you're sort of, because you allude to the man in the airport later on in the book, and you sort of are terrified of flying with him because he looks like a terrorist.
Right.
I'm wondering if it's a first impression thing, that there might be a commonality here. I'm trying to tie this in also to why you sort of stumbled upon the messages with the T-shirts.
Well, I don't know if the messages on the T-shirts are necessarily related to the online dating. I think maybe a false impression. I mean, also, maybe the way that one perceives oneself is probably very different than the way another would perceive that person.
More perception, perhaps.
Perhaps. Okay. The T-shirts came about from when I was working with teenagers.
Yes.
So.
Okay. Well, I wanted to go into your biographical note identifies you as... whether it's you writing this or perhaps the people at Penguin, but is half Israeli and half New York Jew. Mm. Can you elaborate on this? Is this sort of like a good Kirk, bad Kirk kind of thing? Or a Fight Club sort of thing?
Well, my mother grew up in Israel, and my father grew up in the Bronx and downtown Manhattan. So very much New York Jew, and my mother is very much Israeli. So I think I'm sort of a combination of the two.
Well, about what's going on in Gaza right now, what do you have an opinion on this or anything? Or
I mean, of course I have an opinion.
It's pretty mortifying that some people are sort of being extracted against their will, you know.
Well, I think that, are you referring to the Palestinians being extracted?
Yeah, I mean,
I mean, of course, it's terrible. I mean, I think that the vast majority of the Palestinians are victims of a heinous and corrupt government, you know. And like anyone else, most of them want a decent homeland and a place to live. In any event, it's a terrible situation.
In terms of your own heritage, do you sort of relate to either particular party in this crisis? Or
I mean, I'm not going to say just because, I mean, I'm also American. It doesn't mean I support George Bush.
Yeah, exactly.
I certainly...
I'm not suggesting, like, sort of a wear a team flag or a team shirt or I'm just curious to where, how you sort of fit in your Jewish heritage to this particular crisis.
I think that I'm probably a dove, as they would say in those circles.
Okay. Well, I wanted to sort of talk about the book cover, which has apparently received a lot of press. In fact, every single mention that I have found of this book, they can't stop mentioning the cover. And I'll go into sort of more elaborate sort of things. But I wanted to first off find out where the idea from the cover come from. Was it your idea? Is this a response to the Elizabeth Wurtzel bitch cover? Or?
It's not a response to that cover. I don't even know what the cover of
it's the one where she's sort of like, you know, she's given the bird and she has her hair draped over herself and she's like topless.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, it's not a response to that.
Just wanted to vet that. So, well, where did the idea of this come from? Was this purely a promotional idea that came from Penguin or Ken Simon, or
No. I worked with the photographer Mark Seliger.
Okay.
On the cover.
Oh, gotcha.
So I think it was a conceptual idea on our parts the irony or humor of me as Eve offering the apple in the Garden of Eden was sort of hilarious.
Yeah.
And then I mean, I think it's sort of very much in Mark Seliger's style of photographing, of course. Like, it seems like a very classic Seliger photo. So I would really have to credit him with most of that.
Gotcha. Do you think that this might, you know, prevent some people from actually, like, you know, plunging a forward into the book? Do you think that the cover creates perhaps, you know, the correct impression for what is within the book?
Yes, I think the cover creates the perfect impression for what's in the book. I think it's a mix of politics and humor, and I think that it's a good segue.
Okay. Well, I wanted to go to the Republican National Convention, which you protested in your underwear.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to ask you, I think about this because I talked with Norman Solomon recently, and he suggested to me that NPR was, in fact, the most, if the Bush administration wanted to run a propaganda campaign, that NPR would be the most effective conduit because it's something that people trust.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that, similarly, do you think that you sort of parading around in your T-shirt and your underwear will affect change? Or is this because people are more inclined to possibly trust you? Or how does this is this message even extreme enough to sort of, you know, get people to sort of really seriously think about what's going on?
I mean, I think it is a way to get people to think about what's going on, because it's like you just said, every person who's talked about this book has mentioned the cover. So I think in this culture, that is the kind of thing that gets attention. I mean, for me, it's not gratuitous. You know, I mean, I'm not just like running around.
Well, for you or me, maybe. I mean, I'm accustomed to this thing myself. But for, like, say, someone living in a red state, they might look at the cover and say, oh, this is too much for me to handle in terms of accessibility.
I mean, I would really have to say that to suggest that me posing naked on the cover of a book or wearing my underwear to suggest that something like that is corrupting the moral fiber of our society is laughable.
Well,
I mean...
Well, I wanted to sort of... I found an article from... Let me see. Do I have it here? Yes, from the Philadelphia Weekly. And I was sort of perturbed a little bit because... and this sort of touches upon what I was mentioning earlier about whether a T-shirt itself can actually get a message across or whether confusion sort of falls within, you know, either a cover or a T-shirt. But the Philadelphia Weekly said, "We can't even open up Periel Ashenbrand's The Only Bush I Trust Is My Own. The cover alone on which she's pictured naked causes us to immediately start hemorrhaging from our ears, eyes, and anus, which is why we're staying far away from Borders this week, where the, quote, artist and agitprop fashion designer will be, on display." Now, this fascinated me because this comes from an alt weekly, mind you.
Right. Well, I think you're also not reading the rest of that quote, which was, "But Jonathan Ames has endorsed it, and if he told us to jump off a bridge, we'd follow him just about anywhere."
That wasn't so, in the clip that I found, strangely enough, that's on the Philadelphia website.
It is. I mean, I've seen that quote. Yeah. I mean, okay. There's certainly... So what's the question?
Well, the question, I guess, was that, let's say that the Jonathan Ames sort of like, you know, where this is officially snark sort of line was there along with it, and it very, very well have been. Do you think, though, that some people are going to draw this particular type of impression and not actually delve into the contents? Because
I mean, they're
more concerned, like the National Review, for example. You're actually in good company because the National Review actually went after me as well. But the National Review kept calling you some hot, half-naked woman, and it completely obviated, precluded people from actually, you know, from them actually delving into your message.
I mean, I have to be honest with you. The Philadelphia Weekly, I mean, I'm not really fazed by that. And I think it's a little bit pathetic. I mean, if you want to take me to task on something that I've done or something that I've said in an interesting and intelligent fashion, I'm happy to be taken to task. I mean, that just seems sort of childish and, I don't know, somebody sort of miserable writing it. So I'm not so moved by that, but... That having been said, I personally have to say that I do not feel that I really have any problem being taken seriously about what I do. So certainly people are entitled to their little opinions about it.
I guess where I'm going with this is, well, yeah, while this may not faze you personally, the question is would such a sentiment, people actually shocked by a cover or a T-shirt, sort of... Are you concerned that this might actually, you know, prevent people from actually seeing what you're doing with Body as Billboard? How do you propose?
No, I'm not. I mean, I'm not. I mean, it is what it is. You know, I mean, if somebody's going to have, like, a fit because there's, you know, a picture of like this on the cover of a book, I mean, they probably need to relax a little bit. I mean, I think that's, you know, in part what the point is that people are a little bit too uptight about the wrong things. And, you know, the very people who are so scandalized by this cover are the people who are, you know, going back upstairs to their house and watching, like, Who Wants to Marry a Millionaire and flipping through magazines and looking at advertisements of naked sweating girls with their head in some guy's crotch for an ad for perfume and not batting an eye.
Yeah. Well, I guess where the other question I have is, I mean, George Lakoff, for example, has suggested that there's a specific language that liberals or lefties or Democrats, whatever you want to call them, need to sort of adopt to sort of speak in terms that, you know, the layman or sort of the so-called red stater might understand. And I guess since your cover and your T-shirts are, you know, unapologetic about actually having a message behind them. Do you think that these present a way to sort of reach across the divide and possibly sort of get them to think and get them to change?
Well, I think fuck Bush is probably something that people in the red states can understand.
Well,
okay. I think that's probably pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
I mean, look, you know, I mean, for me, it's like I do what I do. I'm very clear about it. And I think it's pretty straightforward and accessible. And again, I mean, if somebody's scandalized by it, I would, you know, encourage them to consider the fact that, like, it's really okay to be naked. And, you know.
Well, you even suggested in your book, too, that you could have taken advantage of all the people, all the Republicans who came through for the National Republican Convention and used a Bush t-shirt that was pro-Bush and perhaps made a bit of capital off of it.
Yes. I'm probably better as a writer than I am as a businesswoman. Oh, so.
Okay. Well, do you see, like, Body as Billboard, you know, taking messages that are perhaps not necessarily as progressive or... you know, taking advantage of, say, a huge block of people, like for the Republican National Convention, as you sort of jokingly alluded to, or, you know, or maybe you can elaborate on that.
I mean, that's not so interesting to me in theory. You know, I mean, I can't say what I will or won't be doing ever in my life, but I mean, if I wanted to churn out sort of vapid, nonsensical t-shirts, I'm sure I could probably come up with a few pretty viable slogans, but I mean, that's sort of the opposite of the point of what I do.
Yeah. Well, you know, we see kids, for example, with, you know, Nike t-shirts and all over the street. You know, I walked here and I actually as an experiment, I counted the number of sort of, you know, advertising shirts that I had seen, and there were easily about maybe 45 over the course of like a 10-block walk.
Yep.
You know, I just did this, and it's just, again, points out
how
prominent this sort of thing is. But one might argue that while they're endorsing a very general brand name that covers a slew of products, your messages are very, very specific. Do you think that people might be sort of putting on the t-shirts and not sort of considering the message in the course of
my t-shirt?
Yeah, your t-shirts, in the same unthinking way that they might put on a Nike shirt because it, you know, they like the logo or something. Is there a way that you could kind of get them to sort of actually sort of think and more specifically about how they put on their t-shirt and what they use for fashion?
Well, I would say that somebody's probably given a good deal of thought and consideration before purchasing and making a commitment to wear a shirt that says, "Does date rape mean I also get dinner?" or "Drug dealer?" or, you know, "What would you give for a great pair of tits?" I mean, I would say that probably it's not mindless like that, but if it is, it's better than the alternative. I think, anyway.
So you would rather have You would rather see sort of mindless people putting on your t-shirts, irrespective of whatever you have to gain from the company standpoint, than to see them, you know, put on the same old t-shirts.
Well, I mean, look, if people were running around eating, like, oranges instead of Big Macs because that was what was most widely available, I would say that would be better.
Yeah.
So...
But if they weren't able to actually think about the choice, like, say by some magical fluke, all McDonald's were completely wiped out off of the face of the planet, and people only had oranges to choose. But they're choosing the orange not necessarily because they're thinking about the orange, but they're because they're hungry.
Well, they're choosing the Big Mac not necessarily because they're thinking about the Big Mac, but because they've been sort of brainwashed to think that this is the only thing to eat. And in fact, it's true that it's the most widely available thing. I mean, if you're asking me, if shirts that are not made in sweatshops that have socially conscious messages on them are the thing that are more widely available than shirts that are made in sweatshops and have vapid slogans on them or are advertising for corporate America, which is better? I mean, I would certainly choose the former rather than the latter.
Yeah. Okay. I guess, though, the question, though, is, though, how do your t-shirts get the consumer to think? And to not only think about, you know, the conscious choice of wearing the shirt, but also to think about the slogan or the message behind them, that, you know, the drug dealer shirt, for example, is about sort of sending relief to Africa. How does it translate to sort of in a general sort of way? Or are they
What do you mean?
I guess I'm just trying to sort of understand how you sort of, how do you know that people are actually seriously sort of thinking about the messages behind these shirts?
I don't know. I mean, it seems like fairly obvious to me that if you're logging on to a website and you're buying a shirt and the whole website is about how X number of million of children are dying from AIDS in Africa, and by buying this shirt, the money that you spend on this shirt is going to go to buy drugs to Africa, it seems to me that the person who's going to take the trouble to do that is probably going to be fairly conscious of what he or she is supporting.
But simultaneously, though, I guess, for example, during the 80s, among the punk community, people wore T-shirts of both, you know, the Soviet anchor, Gorbachev, and Reagan. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily because they believed in it, because they actually liked the imagery. Mm-hmm. And they thought that by endorsing this imagery, they were somehow rebelling against it. So it was sort of kind of an ironic, you know, use of the T-shirt. Mm-hmm. And certainly among people who are going to buy your T-shirts, they will probably be some cluster of that buying consumer block mm-hmm. that will actually think along the same lines.
I mean, I guess, you know, you can't really maintain control or necessarily would want to over every single person who buys one of your shirts, you know? I mean, again, I think, like, this is what I do, and I put it out there into the vastness, and people buy it for, I guess, whatever personal reason. I mean, I don't think you have any way of controlling that or, you know, saying you're only allowed to buy this if you have, you know, signed this document and have promised that you are aware of what you're – I mean, no, it's like – I do what I do. Like, again, I'm very clear about what my motive and my objective is. And I mean, are some people going to buy it because they think it's in a cool store in a hip neighborhood? Probably.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, is that better than them buying a shirt that says, you know, must be 21 to ride here? Yeah, it is. So I don't really give a shit if, you know, they're doing it because it wouldn't be my first choice of reason why they're buying it, but I think it's better than many of the alternatives.
Well, I should also point out that you also had the 100 Women Project as well, and you got a variety of people to wear the shirt. But also, interestingly enough, the thing that was fascinated me in your book was the fact that Sandra Bernhardt, mm-hmm. who everyone would expect to sort of, you know, endorse any T-shirt along these lines without a single problem, didn't even send you so much as a thank you note and wore the T-shirt apparently on a show. Could this be a case of, you know, fashion sort of, you know, without thinking, or was this...
No, I mean, I think Sandra Bernhardt probably endorsed it in the way that, you know, she saw fit. You know? I mean, I do make, you know, a joke in the book about whatever, Sandra Bernhardt wearing it on a TV show.
Yeah.
I don't really have any, let's say, hard feelings about that. You know, I mean, I sent out many shirts to many people, and I mean, I give her credit for having the balls to actually wear that shirt on television. I'm sure a lot of people would not have done as much. So.
Yeah, sure. Now, you studied, I understand, under the late Monique Wittig. And I was just curious how much of your approach was maybe influenced by her and is sort
all
of...
All of it. Everything.
Yes. Shock value.
Everything. Well, I mean, I open up the book with one of her quotes.
Yeah.
About shock value.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, can you elaborate upon what shock value means to you?
Well,
and
may I for
yeah,
a
sure,
moment?
Yeah, sure. Go for it.
If the readers do not feel the shock of words, then your work is not done. Monique Wittig. Which is part of a much longer quote, actually. Monique taught me that, you know, you have to forge ahead, and if it's not shocking, people... I mean, that it's important for it to shock.
Yeah.
I mean, that people need to be fucking shocked. They're sleeping. They're apathetic. They're totally zoned out in front of a television screen. And this country is fucked. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. Monique taught me a lot about what it means to be brave and have the wherewithal to, you know, stand up for what you believe in, and I mean, I don't really consider myself a political activist. I consider myself more of a concerned citizen than...
What distinguishes a concerned citizen from a real political activist in your definition?
I mean, I don't know if I have like a particular definition so formally, but you know, I lived in Thailand for a year, and I used to do a lot of work at an orphanage out there. And I think the nurses who, you know, have like dedicated their lives to working in these orphanages, mm-hmm. those people are activists. One of my very close friends, Anne, who I met when I was teaching in Thailand, you know, goes to Africa and does AIDS work. She's an activist. I mean, people who spend their lives in, you know, refugee camps, helping, you know, Doctors Without Borders. I mean,
yeah.
Those people are activists. I'm just writing and making shirts.
Yeah.
And hoping that...
Well, not only that, but you were at the Republican National Convention. Doesn't that count for something?
Well, yeah, I mean, well, I'm not saying I'm not...
That's going a little bit beyond the
concerns. I mean, look, it's not black and white, you know. I'm just saying, I'm not... I do what I do, and, yeah, you try to make an impact in the way that you can. I mean, certainly I'm part activist, you know. I'm just saying that there are people who are much more, I don't know, in the war zone, let's say.
Gotcha. Well, I wanted to sort of go back to shock value, and I guess, actually, you might be interested to know about this. Yesterday, I actually read an article about the word fuck, which we all like to say, and in fact, you use quite a lot of in your book. The word fuck actually finally made it into the Canadian press's caps and spelling, and that's essentially the Canadian answer to the AP style guide. And they specifically suggested that because fuck is in common usage, it needed to be sort of spelled out in essays and articles. No asterisks, no sort of like, you know, lines where it should be. The shock of the word, you know, isn't really nearly as severe, they were essentially saying, in this mainstream sort of journal, this publication, this guide for editors and writers and the like. And I'm just, you know, it seemed to me a very sort of clear-cut example of how shock value itself is almost kind of becoming more of a commodity. People aren't necessarily so shocked anymore. What do you do when you run out of, you know, shock value?
Well, I mean, I think that's the point, right? I mean, part of what I'm interested in doing and what I've learned from Monique, again, is to try and demystify these taboos. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the word fuck. I mean, if we weren't taught that that was a quote-unquote bad word, then it wouldn't be. I mean, this is, you know, semiology. I mean, this is Roland Barthes. This isn't, you know, I mean, this isn't, like, my idea.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an absurd, arbitrary notion to say that this is a bad word. No, it's not.
It's the old Lenny Bruce routine, you know, about how many niggers do we got in the room. And essentially, you know, and Gregory, spacing out on comics name, stand-up comic, Gregory...
Hines?
Not Gregory Hines, no. 60s. Dick Gregory. Dick Gregory was in the room and said, that man is a genius. But basically, Lenny Bruce went and he essentially said, how many niggers do we got in the room? How many wops? How many spicks? And funny, you know, when you start saying it like this, the word doesn't mean anything anymore. Now, that may be true and that may be good because then people are less shocked by something. But simultaneously, if they're approaching everything with a flat line, if fuck takes on the same sort of context as coffee, or water, you know, then how do we use language in a way that, you know, actually allows people to sort of be stirred up? You know, if everything's at a running out of flat line. If, like, you know, Bret Easton Ellis, for example, you know, goes all the way and has, like, you know, if something along the lines of less than zero where, you know, you have, like, you know, a girl gang raped, you know, if this means nothing anymore, then how do we find meaning and get people sort of stirred up?
I haven't seen that, so I can't speak to it.
Well, the book, I mean, not the film. So.
Okay.
I haven't actually seen the film. I read the book.
I haven't read the book either, so I can't speak to that. But I don't know, a word like nigger to me takes on a little bit of a different...
Yeah.
Weight than a word like fuck. I mean, a word like nigger or spick or faggot. I mean, that are specifically referring to communities of people who are oppressed minorities, let's say. I mean, the word itself, like, you can change the word, but the fact that these people are still being marginalized, like, that's really the problem. I mean, I don't know insofar as everything being flatlined is concerned. I mean, I think that a girl being gang raped, for example, is a problem because women are being raped, and globally,
but this is reflective in a book, and that is a piece of fiction, however. You know.
Okay, I mean, well, yeah. Maybe we shouldn't talk about it then, because I haven't read it, so we're having a conversation.
Well, I was just using it as a sort of an example of how it potentially sort of desensitizes people and perhaps makes them less aware or less caring of a particular... I mean, right now we have a situation where, you know...
Well, the problem with that is, like, what Bell Hooks says. I mean, you have... I'm not a scientist, but there is some period of time in between... you know, sexual arousal and violence in scenes like this where, you know, you're sort of mixing those things and it's very problematic. But again, I mean, I don't want to talk about something that I'm not familiar with because...
Well, I mean, you know, for like example, a t-shirt, do you think that perhaps people can get desensitized or emotionally flatlined to the messages on your t-shirt? And what do you do to up the ante?
I don't know, I guess I'll cross that bridge when I get to it. People seem to be sufficiently, shocked by some of the t-shirts.
Shocked? So, how so?
I don't know, they seem to think that the t-shirts are very shocking.
Shocked or perhaps heightened by it, you know, I mean, there's a difference. Shocked would imply sort of being mortified by the message.
Well, I think people are mortified by the message.
Why do you think that is? How are they mortified exactly?
I mean, they think that a t-shirt that says, "Does date rape mean I also get dinner?" is... How could you put that on? I mean, how could you wear that? That's awful.
Yeah.
Well, no, actually, it's not awful. What's awful is the fact that the term date rape is a term that was, you know, made up by a system that gives less jail time and lighter sentencing to men who are sentenced for date rape instead of rape, and most women are raped by somebody who they know.
Yeah.
Date rape doesn't exist. Rape exists. Yeah. That's what's shocking.
Yeah.
The t-shirt isn't shocking.
Perhaps you should have an edition that has like the word rape underlined.
Yeah, maybe.
Or italicized or something, just so people get the clear message there.
Well, date rape is in quotes
on that shirt. Okay. So. Gotcha. Now, I noticed right now, actually, instead of wearing one of your shirts, I was actually sort of expecting you to maybe to wear a t-shirt, but you're wearing a Motley Crue t-shirt.
Yeah.
So is this a love of Motley Crue, or are you supporting Motley Crue here, or possibly Tommy Lee? I don't know.
I just woke up, first of all.
Okay.
As I told you earlier, I was up at 5 o'clock this morning, and this is one of my favorite shirts. I do like Motley Crue. I actually collect vintage t-shirts, and this is...
Vintage.
Yeah, vintage.
How long have you had that shirt?
Several years. I mean, not as long as when it was from. I guess I can tell you, actually.
Gotcha.
When it's from, but I do...
Wait, do you actually have a catalog or a tag on each particular shirt, or are you just...
No, but it would say somewhere. Usually the vintage shirt says the year somewhere. But, I actually collect vintage t-shirts, okay. So this is one of them. Although I don't see here. I would say this is from the... I would say this is early 80s, 83. Yeah. 83, yes.
Is there a tour on there?
Yeah.
Okay. Boy, that takes me back.
Are you a fan of...
I'm not really all that... They're great music to play, to listen to in pool halls, I find, or driving.
Yeah.
But in terms of... Actually, it's funny, because I actually... When I saw Van Halen once when Vince Neil did the Vince Neil band.
Mm-hmm,
and this was actually the most hysterical sort of pathetic act I had seen, because basically, what did he do? Okay, he did a 10-song set, and like 7 or 8 songs were Motley Crue. So it was just like, really, you know, Vince, if you're going to form your own band, you're going to form your own band. Just call it like the Motley Crue knockoff. Yeah. You know? that was funny. Yeah, that was when, right when Van Halen was pretty much on its last legs, and you know, late sort of Hagar. Late Sammy Hagar period. Mm-hmm.
I guess also it's worth saying that I'm definitely, I'm not innocent of any of the crimes, let's say, that I take issue with. I mean, I'm certainly a victim of that society and culture myself, without a question of a doubt, full of contradictions.
Well, how are you a victim exactly?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm wearing like Miu Miu shoes.
Yeah. Oh, in terms of, I gotcha. But the thing is,
I don't shop retail. I mean, so I really do make a conscious effort not to support particular things. I sort of try navigate my way around it.
But one could also argue that one isn't necessarily a victim, or one really has no other choice in terms of when you go to the store to get clothes. You know, every single one of them pretty much is going to be, you know, manufactured in some export processing zone. Or
well, no, I mean, you can walk around in like Gandhi did, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't, but you can. Yeah. I mean, that is an option.
It is an option, but for most people who unfortunately must, you know, wear a nice dress shirt on a date or something, or must dress up in a tuxedo for some sort of, like, you know, fun little sort of ball, or I don't know. There are specific sort of fashion codes that are, you know, unspoken, that need to be met, that unfortunately...
Yeah, in order to perpetuate a particular economic and social structure.
True, but simultaneously, if you go to the symphony, you're going to get kicked out. You know, I mean, you'll be refrained from enjoying Mahler or something.
Right, and like there's like a guy outside who's like starving to death.
That's very true too.
I mean, I'm saying is that you asked me about the shirt I'm wearing, and my answer is that I certainly participate in the structure, or that, you know, I take issue with.
Gotcha.
I'm not an innocent. I mean, I'm not.
You're aware of.
I'm certainly aware of what's going on here.
Egomania. You declare yourself a cognizant egomaniac in this, comparing yourself with, of all things, Mr. Salman Rushdie.
Well, I don't know. Did I compare myself to him? I think I suggested that he struck me as an egomaniac.
Yeah,
as well.
I'm not talking about the writing, but I'm talking about the image that and the attitude that Mr. Rushdie presents versus what you present, which is you claim that you are you're aware of your own egomania, whereas he it relishes in it.
Yeah.
Can you draw the distinction? Is egomania a good thing? Or
I don't know. I mean, I think I said that I have a sense of humor or a sense of irony about my egomania, where as when I saw Mr. Rushdie walking down the street, there seemed to be not a shred of irony there. Though I've not met Mr. Rushdie, so I can't really.
It's very possible he got lucky or something.
Well, I think he got really, really lucky
now that we're at it, you know. But
I mean,
I don't know what time when you actually saw him. But, you know.
I saw him a couple of years ago.
Okay.
No, I mean, it was hysterical to see Salman Rushdie walking down the street in very regal and peacock-esque. And I am Mr. Rushdie, and I'm so fortunate. But, yeah, I actually had an author escort who had read my book and said, you know, I read the part about Salman Rushdie, and it was so funny because I've driven him around twice. She said he was actually quite nice, but when pressed, I was like, come on, a little bit of...
Yeah.
She's like, well, maybe a little...
Gotcha. And by the way, thank you very much for doing this. I know you're gonna have a cold right now.
Yeah, well, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let me see if I have anything else here. Oh, I wanted to ask you, when I was looking at the dialogue in this, there were a lot of, like, I'm like, and she goes. Do you think this is, kind of valid vernacular for a memoir in terms of, like, I'm like, she goes? Why not? Are you just wanting to kind of be contrarian to the I'm said, she said kind of thing? Or?
Well, I don't know if it's a memoir, but...
Or non-piece, piece but, of essay, non-fiction.
But, even if it is one, I mean, there you go. I mean, it's conversational, this book. It's how I talk, as is clear. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not very formal. I don't know. You know, for me, the sort of concept of writing, well, and then she said, and then he said, and my mother replied, I mean, doesn't really, seems very forced to me.
Well, you could always take the William Gaddis approach and just cut out all he said, she said altogether, let alone character. If you read this, there's this book that William Gaddis wrote called J.R., and the book is entirely just lines of dialogue. That's it. You have to figure out who the hell's saying what.
Okay, yeah. Well, there's another way to tackle it, I suppose.
Thank you, Periel Ashenbrand. Coming up next time, he's hot and he's hip, and he's written himself into his newest novel. Or is it really him? Find out who I'm talking about next week, if you dare.